Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson. How's it going, man?
Hey, buddy. It's good. Just you and me today. Damon can't make it. He's got a very important phone call to take. I'm curious what phone call is more important than this show.
So I mean, Damon's a very important guy. So, you know, it's I understand it. We all have lives outside. Well, I mean, I don't know, except for me. I just kind of live in this nice little podcasting studio that we have here.
I assume it's with his new gig with King Floyd's Bitters, which I'm stoked that he's working with those guys. So,
oh, that's we'll gonna give be him a so pass. Cool. Dang, does this mean I have to get a job with the Bitters company? Is that what has to happen next? Is that going to be part of our contract for next season?
You just do like I do and just make your own.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I sell agave syrup. That's like, it also comes in a tiny bottle and is
and
expensive.
Thanks
so there
for bringing me a bottle of that this past weekend. It is delicious. And, I'm going to make some stuff with it. I think I'm going to cook with it.
I was actually really hoping that you would. In fact, by the way, you kicked off your summer barbecue season over the weekend, which was delightful. Yeah. Had some awesome lamb. Thanks so much for bringing me over. It was a great time. Had a fun chat. Drank a lot of cognac. But yeah, I was hoping when I put that in your hands. Obviously, I like this stuff because it works in cocktails and in food. But I do not have a backyard or a grill. You have both. So I was really hoping that that would get those inspiration juices flowing for you when I gave you that.
100%. 100%. Definitely going to do it.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. Well, you said you had a little something you wanted to talk about from the New York Times to kick off the show. What's going on in the world of news today? What's breaking news, Greg?
I did. Well, so, you know, I mean, like we were saying, you know, you kicked off summer barbecue season yesterday. Spring is here in New York City. The cherry blossoms are blooming outside of my apartment and it looks beautiful. But since Damon isn't here and it's you and me, I figured we would open the show with something depressing.
Oh, great.
So
We'll have Damon's ray of sunshine to get in our way.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no positive spin to ruin us wallowing here. But in the New York Times today, the local paper, I don't know if you get it, there was an interesting exception to a rule. There's a rule in journalism that any headline that ends with a question mark can usually be answered with a no. But today they actually ran a headline that can be answered with a yes. The headline was, "Is this what happens when you introduce a robust social safety net and then take it away?" And it addressed this thing that I've been railing against for a long time, this sort of bad vibes narrative about the economy, where there's this whole thing where it's like, you know, unemployment is low, inflation is down, GDP is up. Why are people so down on the economy? The only thing, first of all of these stories point out that the only things that are still expensive are housing, utilities, and food. So, I mean, if people would just stop bitching about those and focus on the fact that, you know, job creation is up, you know, everyone would get their heads out of their asses and go around whistling all the time, first of all. So that's probably where some of the bad vibes are coming from. But this article also made a really interesting point that, like, I kind of hadn't considered, and I think is going to be relevant to our listeners. That's why I'm not bumming you out for no reason. This is something that I think is going to affect a lot of us. It made this interesting point that 4 years ago during the pandemic, we all saw that not only is our government capable of providing a robust social safety net for people who are hourly workers, for people who are gig workers, for people who are freelancers. They can do it real fast, and it wasn't perfect, but they've shown that they can do it. And now we know that it's not a question of they can't, it's a question of they won't. Because when a lot of those provisions expired in 2021, there were perhaps legitimate fears of inflation. You know, I mean, I'm not an economist, but I do know that a lot of corporations have inflated their prices past the normal rate of inflation. But that's a whole other rant for the top of a whole nother show when Damon isn't here. But it's also, you know, me and you and so many other people, I remember 4 years ago, pretty much exactly, seeing as we're about halfway through March 2024, we're in a place where we were just really scared and had no idea what was going to happen. And everyone was desperate for information, but nobody had any answers because we were in completely uncharted territory. But I remember by the summertime, things were like stable. I had healthcare. I knew how much money was going to be coming in every week. I was able to get on state and federal unemployment. And I remember having this conversation that's always stuck with me. A former employee of mine and good friend and very talented drag queen. I don't know if they listen to this show. I don't know if it's their bag, but Seraphim, what's up? How's it going? Hope you're well. We were having this conversation on Instagram because we weren't meeting in person because we're good liberals. And we were talking about how we felt a little bad that such a period of human suffering had actually allowed us to really make some major advances, both in our own personal lives and on our art. Yeah. And the conclusion we came to is no, we shouldn't feel bad because in a functional society, we should have been able to do this all along. So I don't know. We're getting into we're at the first quarter of a very, what's promising to be a very awful year. And I think I hope that someone with the power to do something, not that, you know, this podcast isn't playing in the White House right now, but I hope that perhaps someone else with the power to do something realizes that, oh, maybe these aren't bad vibes. Like maybe these aren't just young people getting bummed out and being, you know, quarrelsome and truculent. It's like, no, we saw that you can do stuff for us. And now we know that it's not a question of you don't have the resources, you just don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where to take this to bring it back around to our show, but but yeah, I'm seeing the same thing, and I'm seeing like a lot of young people specifically you know, using platforms like Instagram and TikTok to sort of like bash on the things that are going on in the economy when all, you know, all metrics and indicators that we've always used are in the up cycle. And I do understand that, you know, things have changed and maybe those metrics don't mean as much as they used to mean. I also understand that the speed at which you feel those things, just because those numbers are up and things are looking good and inflation is going down, doesn't mean that that's translatable immediately to the grocery store or wherever it is you're shopping. I'm just hopeful. You know, it's because the speed of information is so fast, right? We can see that those numbers are changing, but we don't see it in real life as fast as we can see that it's happening, right? I'm just hopeful that that we're turning in the right direction, and I do totally agree. We have so many potential social safety nets that we could enact, and somehow as a group, we seem to, I don't know, weirdly like enjoy suffering with each other, and instead of enacting those things, we prefer to wallow like we're doing right now.
I agree. Well, if you want more on that, this is actually a pretty big factor in my hilarious book on brunch, which is coming next year. So stay tuned for more on that. But
yeehaw. Does it have a title yet?
Oh, it does. But I'm waiting for there's a product behind this curtain, Souther. We gotta wait until Tim Cook gets here, and then we can reveal it.
Ease it out.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I actually do have a pretty good segue for this because one other depressing thing that I want to throw out there. Well, I mean, probably this is a good thing. This is a good sort of saving me from myself thing. Is that I've noticed now that I'm very solidly and unavoidably in my mid 30s, I can't day drink anymore. I just cannot. My body, I mean, I physically can, but I don't enjoy being hungover at 5 p.m. when the sun is still out. So I just cannot do that anymore. And, you know, after reading this New York Times article, I was like, oh my God, I would really want a drink right now. And fortunately, thanks to the rise of NA spirits, I can. And speaking of non-alcoholic spirits, we have in the studio today, Yuna Osrion. Yuna, how are you doing?
Hi, everyone. How's it going?
Hello. I'm great. Hey, did you like that segue? I was working on it all morning.
That was pretty nice.
Pretty good.
I like it. That was great.
Thank you. They're always
social evolution. That's awesome. I mean, to your point about that article, I think it definitely has allowed a lot of people to see what their capabilities are and if they're able to, you know, start their own thing. I kind of started my own thing after working for a few different agencies with the spirit side and the non-alcoholic side too. But yeah, day drinking, moderation, all those really cool things.
Day drinking, not just for booze anymore.
That's brilliant.
Thank you.
I love it.
Yeah, you can, that one's free. You can have that one. That's your, yeah. That's your, part of your goodie bag for coming on the show.
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, talk to us about some of these ventures that you started. I actually didn't know up until this moment. You and I have chatted a couple times, but I didn't know that these were also the product of the shutdown. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I started a clothing company that focuses on uniforms a little while ago. I've been kind of in the bar and restaurant scene for a little while, bartending, managing all that. Then I started working with Pernod Ricard, working with Absolut for a little while, and then their luxury portfolio. So I kind of cut my teeth on the ambassadorship thing in Boston for 5 years with them, but I was in the hospitality industry for about like 7 or 8. So kind of got to understand how it all works. Mom is still pissed I didn't go to dental school, but it's okay. I kind of really like what I've done and where I am and who I am, but kind of saw the need for bespoke uniforms while also working with restaurants, and then started doing ambassadorship kind of in conjunction with it. I think I like to create a lot, and sometimes the ideas I create move faster than all of the logistics. So I create it, and then I kind of like form the company afterwards and kind of just blindly go. Just push myself to see if it works in the market, to see if there is a need for it, and then establish it. And that's kind of how I've found myself in the non-alcoholic space. I was working with C-Lip in Boston part-time. And then they moved me here to New York to work on the regional side of things. And then I saw such an amazing demand for spirit-free, non-alcoholic beverages. And there were so many of them coming out mm-hmm. at once.
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden, you know, there's a bottle shop and it was full of non-alcoholic brands. And I got to discover a lot of different taste profiles. I understood the difference between 0.5 and zero proof, and you know, understanding the sober space and how that affects everything, and then seeing the restaurant side of things. Like personally, myself, I drink, but I also love incorporating non-alcoholic beverages into my night out. Just kind of keeps you out longer and mm-hmm. hurts a little less in the morning, but. I started to become close with some of the founders, and I absolutely love working with founders because I love giving them the direct, information from a place like New York, which is such a crucial market to win, to launch any brand and to be able to take that to the next level of things. So I got close with a lot of founders when I was still with Seedlip, and I just said, I should probably do this. I've worked, in agencies and with agencies for a long time. And I kind of, at the end of the day, it's menu placements, relationships, like the key pillars to growing a brand don't change across, you know, alcohol or not alcohol. You kind of have to still apply the same thing to any brand to see growth in any kind of market. But I learned how to do that. And I took it to my own agency called Catch All Collective. And I have 4 different brands in my portfolio, hopefully 5 or 6 coming soon. I work with Pathfinder, Everleaf, Farragaya, and Prima Pave. It's a sparkling Italian wine, which is amazing. All these brands are really, really special. And one of the ways that, you know, building a portfolio, you have to kind of understand competition within your portfolio, and building something like this, everyone plays really well in the playground. So you can make a Pathfinder spritz. You can do, you know, you can do a Negroni with a few of the, you know, Everleaf and Pathfinder, and you can do an old fashioned. You can do so much with the brands that I've put together that I'm very proud of the portfolio that I've brought, because each brand kind of enhances each other, and I can bring in an entire portfolio to a restaurant or bar that has never seen or experienced non-alcoholic products and say, hey, you can do so much with all of this. And you can also put it in your alcohol, in your cocktails that could have alcohol to even lower proof them. So giving people tools in the space really excites me. And I love giving people options. So that's my main thing. I love it when people have options when they go to a bar or restaurant and they can choose to drink or not to drink. It's up to them. So yeah, that's
I have a question. When you're dealing with brands in the mm-hmm. alcohol space, which you did in the past, the word brand, that's what comes to mind, right? You get to a place where you create a relationship with either the bar or the guests themselves, where they say, I want X brand in my Negroni or X brand in my, are you finding it difficult to get to that same place with NA spirits? Brand recognition, brand calling, like I'm going to have a Negroni, but I want Pathfinder in there. How do you navigate getting the general public to treat NA brands just like they treat spirit brands?
I don't think the space is big enough yet to have super competing categories. Like, you know, there's 100 different gins out there, and with the non-alc space, there's only two or three different things that exist that kind of are able to fill that space. So, and the other thing with the non-alcoholic space, a lot of these brands are kind of creating their own profiles, like taste profiles. So with Everleaf, they have three different varietals: Forest, Mountain, and Marine. So all of those things are tastes, right? So the categorization of these non-alcoholic spirits are kind of very different than what we're used to in the alcohol space. So people know what a gin is, know what a tequila is, but they're so unique that if someone was to recreate Forest by Everleaf, they would need to honestly copy a lot of what goes into that, you know, saffron, all these amazing notes that Everleaf has. So it's like a different jungle, right? So you kind of have to lead with a cocktail that's very tasty with these brands, like a spritz, for example. An Everleaf spritz versus a Pathfinder spritz are two completely different taste profiles. So if you want something more bitter or if you want something more floral, that's kind of the direction you have to take it versus something that I would rather have, you know, Pathfinder and this Negroni versus Dr. Amaro or some other brand that's there. I think that there are not enough brands out there that do the same thing in the non-alcoholic space.
I think that's really interesting. And it reminds me of something that I think we learned and then unlearned and are learning again when we talk about non-alcs. Because one of the first brands in this space is actually an old acquaintance of yours, Seedlip. And I remember when Seedlip mm-hmm. came out, one thing that I don't think any of us really appreciated how cool this was that they were doing this at first is that they don't try and be like, this is Seedlip's whiskey, but without alcohol. This is Seedlip's tequila, but without alcohol. They were like Spice 47, ginger, you know, mm-hmm. they were their own thing. And it goes back to what I always say about, like, I don't eat fake meats. You know, I don't want to eat a bunch of plants pretending to be meat. Like, I would so much rather have a super dope portobello mushroom burger or a super dope black bean burger than like beets pretending that they're a cow. If I want meat, I'm going to eat meat. Like, that's just and it's kind of the same thing with alks and non-alks. If I want a drink, I'm going to have a drink. But if I want to have a drink without alcohol, I don't want to have something that's pretending to be gin. I think it's kind of cool that it seems like we forgot that. And I think it's cool that that's one of the things that your portfolio has really embraced is bringing those, centering flavors rather than trying to retcon these things that people already know what they taste like when they reach for that bottle.
Yeah, it's a really interesting space to be in because it's more flavor first. And you want something that tastes nice, right? You want something that has mouthfeel. You want something that has, one of the things that I kind of make sure that when people make non-alcoholic cocktails is, can you drink this in like 7 seconds? Then we need to enhance it. So people sip on it. This is an interesting thing to talk about. Let's talk about value. Let's talk about what it means to have value in a drink. So is the value drinking something for 20 minutes with your friend? Like, let's just say a Negroni, right? I shouldn't chug a Negroni. And
well, right, that's, we've brought this up many times in the past. Like, there, alcoholic drinks give you a little bit of a sort of slap on the wrist, a kind of warning, like,
yeah,
there's something here that's totally, that you shouldn't be, you know, mm-hmm, slamming this and chugging it down. And NAs don't have that. And I struggle with that a lot. I struggle right, with, like, and I think I've never directly tied it to value, like it sounds like you're about to do. So I'm curious to hear what you're about to say about, you know, where does that value come from for not only, again, the guest, but, you know, I'm in business, right? So where does that value come in for me, the business owner as well?
Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I denote value with time. Time spent on something. So if you're at a bar and you're enjoying yourself and it takes you 5 seconds to drink a drink that is a non-alcoholic drink, yes, it might be $11, $12, whatever that looks like, but your friend who got something with alcohol is still sipping on theirs and enjoying it. And the nuances of that drink open up with ice, and the complexities of something with alcohol is amazing. We know how it works. We've played the game, we've made the cocktails. But to be able to take something with no alcohol or low alcohol and do the same thing, that is the challenge that I bring to bartenders and beverage directors, because I really do think it can be done. I think if you're able to create something that someone sips on, and it can be using sour, it can be used, not the mix, but like the taste profile to slow someone down. Like, you know, they're called like little speed bumps, right? You can use carbonation to slow something down. You can use temperature. So I really do want everyone to explore. It's kind of the psychology of drinking in a sense. So to bring a drink that has no alcohol compared to a drink that has alcohol, if you're able to increase how much someone spends on that drink with their time, then they're enjoying themselves. Then they're not looking at an empty drink every 2 seconds, and they're valuing what they're having. This drink is, you know, having different nuances as I sip it. Like the cherry blossoms are opening up. The, you know, the bergamot is showing as the ice melts. So it's really important to work with brands that have complexity. And if you're able to tie in more complexity to slow someone down, even if you lower proof a drink, even if you make a lower proof Negroni, even if you add a little bit of gin that lower proofs the drink, time, I think, is very valuable for anyone at a bar, right? Not too long, but like just enough time to be able to enjoy something with someone and to stay the same with someone that is drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a major key, that when people are building menus, they need to take that into consideration, because someone that is drinking a $12 spritz and someone that's drinking a $15 to $20 Negroni, I think they should be enjoying their time at the space the same. So that's my kind of take on value and time.
Let's talk about when you said you were bartending, were you dabbling into this space at that time, or did this come later? And if so, like, how did you justify or rectify that same equation that you just described in your kind of day to day, you know?
So I started working at the Mandarin Oriental in Boston. It was one of my first, bartending cocktail server kind of, gigs, and they had to have a non-alcoholic menu. And they used fruit juices at the time. So they used whatever cocktails they had. They were able to create 4 different cocktails that were non-alcoholic. But per Forbes standard, it's something that had to be there, right? And this was in 2012, I think, 2012, 2013. And seeing people, and this is like juices, this is like not non-alcoholic products, this kind of didn't exist back then. It was really important to have options, because options are still dollars in the cash register. Soda water, you can only charge so much for soda water and bitters. So seeing the value that non-alcoholic products bring to any restaurant, any bar, any hotel, I think is worth having on any menu just to it's like if you build it, they will come mentality. So I saw that and I had my own program at this place called Liquid Art House. It's no longer here, but I was able to implement 2 or 3 non-alcoholic cocktails. And honestly, for every 6 drinks, one of them would be a non-alcoholic option. And it's, you don't really know what anyone's kind of going through. You don't know if someone's on medication. You don't know if someone is just choosing not to drink for a week, you know, it's, but they still want a fancy glass. They want nice ice. They want just to not have a Coke or a non-alcoholic or a soda water bitters. But I think that like just giving people options is really important.
Well, I think also a large part of that is, yeah, like you said, and like we talk about on the show all the time, you know, if people are going out, just people never go to a bar just for a drink. Like it's cheaper to do that at home. You know, people are out there for, you know, oftentimes for companionship. I can't count the number of times that I've said to myself, I'm like, oh my God, I really don't feel like drinking tonight, but I'm really excited to see this person. And we have plans to meet at a bar because that's the industry that we're in and that's where we meet. And also it's January. So like we can't go to the park or anything like that. And I think having that option on there is really important. And I've personally been, you know, I've even started to avail myself of that option, like on nights where, again, I was excited about the company, but not super excited to get intoxicated because like maybe I had an early morning the night, the next morning, or I had a late night the night before and I'm still recovering. I think it's important to have that. I am very curious to hear a little bit what it's like for you to manage not just one of these, but a whole portfolio of them and sort of what are the challenges there? Because, you know, we've all seen and heard people on the show talk about, you know, these are the advantages of my particular NA spirit or beverage or RTD that I'm making. And then we've had portfolio managers on, but you're, as far as I'm aware, the first sort of portfolio manager specializing just in NA. So I'd love to hear what that journey has been like. I'd love to hear what sort of education gaps you've had to close with the people that you're talking to about your products. And I'd love to hear if there was anything that you encountered in this journey where you're like, oh shit, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Buckle up. It's, I think that, the first step in this was, bringing in brands that I believe in, bringing in people that understand how this kind of works, understands how, you know, there's going to be other brands in the portfolio, but please understand that everything is going to complement each other. Because it's not only management, externally, it's also management internally, right? So it's like, hey, you know, this, I saw that there's a Everleaf cocktail on one menu. Like, could you like, you know, present us for that menu too? And it's kind of managing, cause you know, I believe in full transparency with everything. It's like, these are the brands that, you know, I'm going to be presenting alongside. I'm also going to pre-batch some cocktails with both the brands in it. So I kind of have strategy behind how I work with the brands together and kind of how I work with the brand separately. If there's a place that, you know, has a price point restriction, I will bring a certain brand. If there's a place that has, you know, absolute aversion to anything that resembles sparkling, I don't know what place that would be, but it's just, I'm more so strategized. Oh yeah, that place. But it's also, I assess what the buyer needs and I don't overdo it. I think that's a really important thing. I think it's very important to earn your trust with anyone. And so I'm not going to waste anyone's time by just throwing everything at them. I want to show them that I'm if there's a fire drill, I will put it out. If there's a fire, I will put it out. If you need a case of something, I'll deliver it to you. So I think that managing relationships is really important internally and externally. So if like Sebastian from 11 Madison Park, he and I have been working together with all these non-alcoholic brands. It's on the menu there. Takuma from Martinis. Just a lot of people that have been able to support kind of what I'm doing and vice versa. If they ever need anything, I'm there. If any other places that I brought these products to, need something, I'm there. So establishing a relationship with anyone that I work with is my number one priority on both ends, the clients and both clients, restaurants and bars and all the founders that I work with here. And then another really important thing is getting these brands in the hands of curious people, people that are not afraid to be like, what happens if I mix this and this together and then add this? And then all of a sudden it's one of the best things ever. Today I was drinking a beet juice. I was like, I wonder what matcha would taste like with this beet juice. I was like, I don't know. I'm going to figure it out. It's just, it's all play, right? It's I haven't done it yet. Okay. I saved a little bit of beet juice, and I have a bunch of matcha. And I was like, I don't know. It could be absolutely disgusting, or it could be like the coolest taste profile ever. So a lot of what I love doing is playing. So getting these brands in the hands of people that also like to play is really rewarding for me, because the things that they create, they're really proud of and they're really excited. And they're also really excited to put something on the menu that they can stand behind. So managing a portfolio, I think, gives me, it's not edge, but it's also allowance to give people options. And I say this to all the buyers I work with. I was like, I'm your quarterback. So text me with what you need, and I'm going to be the one working with wherever these brands are distributed from, finding, tracking, understanding when it's going to get to you. So I want to take a lot off of the plate for buyers, because in the non-alcoholic space right now, especially in New York, because of the laws, distribution is extremely challenging. Also, million-dollar idea. You guys want to start a distribution company? So there, I see you. Greg? Well,
I mean, I would think that, yes, it's difficult, because distribution here, alcohol and grocery don't mix, right? So you probably have hurdles with that. You can't just be on the same truck with the booze. But that also means that you're a grocery. You can be on any Baldor truck. You can be on any Cisco truck. You can be, seems like that would open up distribution for you. You know, you're not locked into the third party system where I have to order, you know, I can only get Heinz ketchup from Whole Foods, but if I want French's mustard, I got to go to Key Foods. That's how our system is set up, right? You can be on any truck. You can be on multiple trucks, right?
Yes. But the tricky part is getting into the distributor. So a few of my brands work with Chef's Warehouse, and that alone is interesting, because Chef's Warehouse are traditionally known to work with chefs. So the conversation with beverage directors and buyers, I don't know if they've ever met those people. So Chef's Warehouse is currently trying to expand their non-alcoholic portfolio because they see such a space, there's a need and amazing space that they can fulfill in the market. You know, the Boissons of the world, I guess there's only one, so Boisson. They're expanding themselves, and they have trucks in New York, and they have storefronts as well. But it's just the distribution. Union Beer is one of the only places, and there are other places too. But Union Beer is one of the only distribution, you know, houses that people really know that they can add on non-alcoholic product to their to their beer, to their wine, whatever that looks like. But it's the distribution thing is so tricky and complicated, and I don't know if you want to text or email four distributors for four different brands on a Tuesday. So it's
sadly, but truthfully, that's how we have to do it for booze. So it wouldn't be out of pocket to have to do that. But it seems to me that, you know, you have a distinct advantage here that maybe isn't coming into play yet, because it simply isn't realized by the consumer, being the buyer at any restaurant or bar, and also the distributor. Like, again, I can order, I can only get Campari from Southern, right? Mm-hmm. If I want Campari, it's coming through Southern, or I don't get it. No one else is allowed to carry it. But you could have Pathfinder with Chef's Warehouse and Baldor and Cisco, and then, whoever I'm happen to be ordering from today, I can get this also, right? There seems to be that'll be a pipeline in the future, but I think, it's still that separation of sort of, you know, high proof spirit and grocery that's got people a little bit confused as to where they can get things, right? Like, it's very confusing to my consumer that they can't go to the regular guest, you know, that they can't go to Astra Wine and Spirits. They can pick up all the tequila they can carry, but they can't buy limes there. That's grocery and that's spirit. We can't do that, right? So that's why I'm allowed to, as my store, I can sell bitters. They're considered a grocery item, even though they're high proof. That's why you can't pick up bitters at Astra Wine and Spirits. One of the best liquor stores in the world can't carry this thing that the consumer sees as booze, right? So it's all these stupid laws and rules. but you get to usurp that because you're totally non-alcoholic. I think that probably is going to, and I wanted to ask earlier, I think that's probably going to help you when you start to go outside of state. You know, if you're a spirit, to get into different states is basically like getting into a different country. But with a non-alcoholic, you can just mail it in the mail if you want, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is, there's a few of my brands that are really pressed to get into regular distribution, like in other states. New York is a very interesting market. It's probably one of the reasons why I'm able to have catch-all is because like you were saying, grocery versus wine shops versus, you know, other things that non-alcoholic products can't be into. It's like an archaic law, but I also think because of that law, the bottle shop boom in New York really happened because they saw a need for there's a lot of non-alcoholic brands, and you know, Douglas was one of the first to create Spirited Away before Boisson kind of took that idea and grew a bunch of different bottle shops. But I think that this is the first time that we see consumers driving a market because they were the ones that were curious to be like, what is this non-alcoholic bottle shop? So you're saying everything here has no alcohol? Mm-hmm. Like what? So, you know, I think consumers were able to have access to things like Pathfinder, things like, you know, Everleaf and brands that restaurants and bars didn't touch for 2 years after that. And I think this is one of the first times we're seeing consumers drive a trend, which I think trend has become something that's a little bit more permanent now.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like flipped, right? It's flipped on its head. It's the first time I'm seeing something that people are pushing to have more of in the market.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's the interesting, I feel bad using this as an example, but the one that springs to mind is like Heineken Zero had a big ad push on the subway recently. And I remember looking at it and be like, who asked for this? Like maybe this is me being a snob. It probably is me being a snob if I'm being honest. But for me, I'm never going to reach for a Heineken and be like, man, I wish that this was non-alcoholic. Again, like there are non-alcoholic beers out there that I really enjoy, but that doesn't seem like that's that sort of space that particular brand occupies. But what's interesting is you're saying that, you know, there we're so used to having new concepts and ideas pushed on us by companies being like, you like this, right? Watermelon Oreos being one of my favorite punching bags of all time. But it's so interesting, like you said, to have a trend that arose because there was such an overwhelming demand for it.
Yeah,
consumer demand obviously drives market deliverance, right? So the consumer has suddenly turned their eye towards non-alcoholics in such a vehement way that we've had a rush to market of a bunch of products that are maybe not great.
Yeah, they're okay. No, listen.
If you like it,
some aren't even okay. But that's what happens. We get a rush to market to feed that demand that's very high. And then we're going to have shake off. The ones that aren't so good are going to fall away because the consumer, they'll buy it because they see it and it exists. But then they'll be like, not that great. I'm not going to buy it again. So the ones that they are buying again will be the ones that remain. The cream will rise to the top. And then over the course of, you know, how long did it take for beer to become, you know, crack the code? Like there are now beers on the market. I had a Guinness Zero for the first time on St. Patrick's Day. And if you didn't tell me that it was the Zero, I wouldn't have known, to be honest. I would have been like, man, how have I had 10 of these and I feel fine? You know, they've cracked
years
the code.
Of practice, so how long, that's how.
Right. But how, yes, thank you. but how long did that take for beer? And it, hopefully, you know, it won't take as long in a spirit world. But I believe, and I think I've even said this on the show before, we're not there yet. But there will be a time in the not too distant future, 10 years, let's call it, where you'll walk into any average bar and there will be tequila, NA tequila, whiskey, NA whiskey, and they'll be good. They'll be an analog to everything on the bar, and they'll be delicious. Right now, I feel like we're still in the hit or miss on the analogs. So what we're having to really focus on are the ones that simply don't exist, as you said. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing like the thing that Seedlip is making, because they're not trying to make an analog. They're trying to make something unique. But I feel it. If everyone's making something unique, then we're going to have too much of this product on the market, you know? there are only so many spirit brands. There are only so many, I don't know, vermouth and amaro brands, or styles, I should say. And if we flood with too many of the NAs, then that market gets diluted by sheer volume, right?
Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, then.
I think that at the end of the day, you want to drink something that tastes nice, right? Like you want to drink something that has complexity, that's done well. You want to experience something that you're like, I will have another one. Mm-hmm. And it's the best test for any drink. Yeah, I'm having another one. but I think that put into the hands of people that know what they're doing, you really can make some very cool taste profiles and beverages. And I mean, at the end of the day, that's what a cocktail is, isn't it? It's something very tasty in a glass.
Yeah.
And I think you're right with beer. Like Athletic is fantastic. That's incredible. And a lot of the brands I'm working with, some of the buyers are making shandies. They're making really tasty shandies because with beer, it is one of the closest, like this has alcohol in it, right? So they add aroma, they add, you know, a float, they add complexity, they add something extra to that beer. So shandy, maybe there's a, for spring trend alert, maybe the shandies, the non-alcoholic shandy is making its way to the menu.
You heard it here first, folks.
You heard it here first. It's true though. There's two different places that I went to and we're R&Ding cocktails. Alex with Rains at the William, he made me this incredible Everleaf cocktail using Athletic, and it came in a gorgeous glass and it just kept getting better as I was drinking it. It was amazing. And Michael Pedicine from Gabriel Kreither made a Pathfinder Shandy and like, you know, with an Alsatian kind of twist. And I was like, okay, do you guys talk? But I think that to your point, Souther, beer has got it. Yeah. Beer is doing its thing and it's delicious. You can have a few of them. That ritual and that longevity that you spend on an Athletic is the same exact that somebody with a 5% beer is also having. So you guys are drinking at the same time, the same consumption. So if you add a few different, you know, complexities or notes or just curveballs to beer, you get a shandy. I think that maybe spring summer trend alert.
Right, and beer again. You know, I think that we often get caught up as human beings in the like what is right now, and we, you know, the old it takes 10 years to be an overnight success, right? Non-alcoholic beer 10 years ago kind of still sucked, mm-hmm. right? Even 15 mm-hmm. years ago, it kind of sucked, right? We had few choices, you know, O'Doul's, but they've over time they've cracked the code. Well, I feel like, you know, there's a rush to market with a bunch of these things and the code is yet to be fully cracked. We've got a lot of delicious things, but I feel like they're a little bit disparate. They don't we've got to kind of like shake them into categories and formulate them. Otherwise it's just an overwhelming preponderance of choice. You know, we've definitely talked about this on the air before that, you know, alcohol is the modifier. So, you know, everything is non-alcoholic. But if mm-hmm. we're going to start specifically calling certain things non-alcoholic, then we have to like start boxing and categorizing, right?
In London, one of the like Everleaf, one of the brands I work with, one of the founders, Dan, he kind of refers London cocktails or menus as like a little time capsule. Like they're like the US isn't there yet, but this is what we've seen. No, in terms of like, they have non-alcoholic categories. Mm-hmm. They have non-alcoholic cocktails. Then they have juices. Then they have like, you know, like non-alcoholic beer. They have different categories for different things. And mm-hmm. to your point, juice is juice, orange juice, grapefruit juice. But then you have things that cost the same as a spirit in a section that has no alcohol, but the amount of time, the ice program, the technique is all still there. So there are so many menus in London and kind of Europe in general that have put non-alcoholic options as just as important in its own bubble with cocktails. So I see it coming. I see it happening. There's a lot of places.
No, it's undeniable. It's happening.
Yeah.
I don't think you're blind if you don't see it. I think it absolutely is coming. It's sort of kind of here right now. It's just mm-hmm. about to really cascade over, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on there. I would be really interested to hear your thoughts on value and what non-alcoholic brands bring to the table for the restaurants that you work with. And also mm-hmm. what do you not like about the space? Because, you know, everybody has a like and a dislike. And I think that it's important to kind of understand you have so much experience in this space. You've seen so many things, mm-hmm. you've tasted so many things. What do you like and what do you not like? What do you see coming and what do you want to avoid?
I think the part that I don't like is still heavy with categorization and nomenclature. As I just sort of talked, right? NA is, everything is NA. When you get up in the morning, you have a cup of coffee, mm-hmm. then maybe some orange juice with your breakfast, and then you carry on with your day and you get to work and you have lunch and you have a Coca-Cola. You didn't have four NA drinks. You were just having liquid, right? You're going to have a beer later. Now you're switching to alcohol, right? Alcohol yeah. is the modifier. Everything mm-hmm. is NA until we add alcohol. So it's troublesome to me to get around this part. As you just said about maybe the menus that you've seen in London, categorizing and putting in their own bubbles, I feel like that's long been the norm. What I'm doing at my spaces instead is putting NA and low ABV right in the main list where it would belong as you read the list, right? But I put ABV next to everything. So some say fucking zero and some say, you know, 21% and everything in between, right? So the consumer can just read a menu and they don't feel like, oh, I got to read the side menu, the kids menu. I'm at the kids table now. I'm not on the main menu. You know, just like at restaurants, you know, my personal business, my company, my restaurants are all vegan, but at other restaurants that I've worked in the past, we didn't separate things that were vegetarian or vegan into their own list. It's just on the list. Maybe there's an icon that lets you know, right? But it falls in the list where it should fall, you know, sort of. So that's how I think about alcohol and non-alcoholic drinks on my menus. Listen, I'm all for it, for people to have a good time. I just think, and to feel included and to feel like they got a fancy glass and all the things you said to feel like they're just right in the mix with everyone that they're with, you know, it does seem a bit obtuse to say, well, you know, everybody got a fancy cocktail and you got a, you know, a Shirley Temple in a red plastic cup with crushed ice, you know, like, but I also still think that it's on the consumer's shoulders still to examine where they're at when they're asking for these things. And that only comes to mind because of my very peculiar bar, Amore Amargo, where we've literally been open for 13 years with only water as a non-alcoholic ingredient. I can't make you anything but water if you come in asking for NA, you know? And they do, they come in and ask for it. And I'm like, look, that's just not what we do here. You've come to a burger joint asking for sushi or vice versa. Like, it's just not a thing I do. So I think it's still, you know, we want to be inclusive, of course, but we also want to, I don't think exclusive and exclusivity is a bad word. And I can justify that by saying, for me, the most exclusive restaurant in the world is McDonald's. Why? Well, it's very brightly lit, which I don't find a comfortable place to eat when it's very brightly lit. They make food that I don't particularly enjoy. The seating is made of plastic and uncomfortable. There are many, many children running around. They have excluded me. And guess what? This is great for me because I don't really want to be there. And it's great for them because they don't really want me there. Right. So exclusivity isn't a bad thing, you know, in those terms in regards. So, again, I think it's a tide that's inevitable. This is coming. There's no stopping it. And we got to, you know, we've always got to be forward thinking and on board with things like this. But I think that there's still a bunch of kinks that need to be worked out as we continue to move forward. And I think categorization is going to be very helpful. Otherwise, we're going to get to a place where we just have literally, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of products that simply there's nothing else like them. So then you got to, do I have them all? Do I have some of them? And then someone comes in and asks for the one that they like, but I don't have that one and nothing else is like it at all. So I can't even give them an analog. Where do you get to that place? And that's kind of maybe where I started the conversation with, like, how do you begin to get some brand loyalty and some brand request? You know, like people come in and say, I'll have a Belvedere martini. Well, okay, I don't have Belvedere, but I've got something else that I can offer you that's similar or they'll jump category. They'll say, scratch that, then I'll have a Makers and Tonic, you know, like, so how do we get to the place where the consumer has a better boxable categorization so that they can ask for the thing that they want and it makes sense for the business to carry enough of this stuff to at least help them out?
Do you think that the category is going to be the cocktail? Let me explain. So Spritz,
Sure. There
are four brands that I work with that can be fit, all of the brands you can make a spritz with. Do you think that the category is going to be the drink, like an old fashioned? I think I have maybe two brands in my portfolio that could make something similar to an old fashioned. You can have it down. You can sip it slowly. You can enjoy it with food. It's just throwing it out there.
No, yeah, I think that that's kind of where we are right now, and that's better for me, the business, but it's not better for you, the the makers, or you, the distributor of a product. You need to get to the place where people specifically ask for Pathfinder or Everly, or right. Mm-hmm. You want to get to the place where they say, "I'll have a spritz and Everly spritz," right? They want the thing you sell, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think,
and then if I don't have it as the business, then I can say I don't have that, but I've got this, and we can go down the road of like it's still a spritz, it's got some similar qualities. But even that, you know, I see a hurdle there too. Now that I'm saying it out loud, and weirdly, the interview has gone to me.
we're just chatting,
Southern T. Yeah, this is your life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you have so much experience in this, so it's right. Nice to hear.
So I could see, you know, I can absolutely see someone coming in and saying, "Can I get a whatever, you know, make me a daiquiri." There's so many rums to choose from, right? And if they say, "I'll have this specific rum," then I, as a bartender, I've got some knowledge about that rum they asked about, so I can drive them to a rum that I have that is in a similar category, right? But again, if there are hundreds of these NAs and someone asked for one specifically and I've never had that one, I don't even know where to, was that one floral? Yeah. Is it dark and brooding? Is it medicinal? Is it bitter? Is it, you know, earthy? Like, then suddenly you're having to quiz your own guest instead of being able to service them. And they don't know. The guest is largely not armed with a vocabulary about these things. So they just know they like it, you know?
Right. Brand loyalty and brand awareness. It's the first question you asked. I think that it's extremely important. I think one of the brands that has done that the best is Pathfinder.
I do too.
Because
And not just only, Craig works at the Maury Martin.
Craig is the best. Shout out Craig. But it's
the Viking, we call him.
He is the Viking. Lumberjack Viking. what a vision. I think
the tall dude with a thick shock of red hair and a long giant red beard.
Yeah. And if he wears flannel, he's a lumberjack that day.
Yeah.
But Craig is actually one of the founders of the Pathfinder.
Mm-hmm.
And what an incredible, versatile alcohol-free spirit. I think that the branding alone, just, you know, the all-seeing eye, mm-hmm. the captivating literature on the bottle. Mm-hmm. I think that when you pick that bottle up, you want to look at it.
Yeah.
You want to read it. You want to understand it. And then you're like, you know what? I will taste this. Mm-hmm. So I think Pathfinder has been one of the brands that not only am I super fortunate to work with them, I think they have such a clear vision and who they are and what they are. That it should be like studied. It's one of the brands. Not only is there like a cult following, and also how terrible is it to find something that you're like, this looks so cool, this is amazing, and then you pour it in a glass and you're like, damn it, this isn't it.
Yep.
Yeah. But what the heck? So Pathfinder is opposite of that. You look at it, you read it, you fall in love with it, and you drink it, then you fall in love with it some more. And then you start playing around with it, and you're like, what can't this do? So I think with brands in general, I think creating a conversation on your bottling, being able to spark creative juices when you look at something and just kind of be intrigued with it, is incredible. I think, you know, Hendrix was able to do something like that, like with their bottle and their marketing too. So yeah. I think in this space, because it is, I wouldn't say it's necessarily diluted, because as you were saying, Souther, there's just a bunch of like flavors out there that you can put in a drink, add tonic to it, and you have this taste profile. Mm-hmm. I think Pathfinder stands out to me as something that is absolutely intriguing and really, really cool. So,
and unique. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing spirit, and I love the label. The first time I saw it, it kind of reminded me of like an old timey patent medicine, which I think is great because it kind of puts you in an adjacent headspace to booze, while not specifically mm-hmm. promising like this is gonna be like a whiskey or this is gonna be like a rum, right. Which I think is neat.
I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson.
And this is an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup, the critically acclaimed award-winning syrup that helps gringo bartenders better make margaritas, Negronis,
Lou, hold and up, hold up, wait.
Old
are you just
fashions?
This is how you start your podcast.
What?
It's not an ad for Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Well, of course it is. I'm just cutting costs by not paying writers to make something new. I'm just using an old script.
You pay writers?
Is that some kind of jab?
No, I'm just saying
What are you saying?
Well, look, we've got this amazing syrup that's made in an ancestral manner, cooked down from the sap of the agave, harvested the way these families would to make pulque. It's a quality product. It deserves a quality presentation.
Yeah, okay, hang on. Ancestral agave syrup is made by real families following traditional methods. Unlike the industrial Blue Weber syrup you get everywhere else, Ancestral is cooked down from agua miel harvested from Salmiana in Hidalgo, Mexico. It is the grade A Vermont maple to the sticky diner syrup you've been using for your cocktails. Ingredients matter, both in how your cocktail tastes and how you treat the earth. Ancestral is better for both. Is that good?
Sure. Or maybe confusing instead of cheesy. Look, just visit ancestralagave.com to learn more and to order your world-class agave syrup today.
And we'll call that a wrap. Catch you next ad, Greg.
Hasta pronto?
Ancestral Agave Syrup, available online at ancestralagave.org and wherever Greg and Lou were able to coerce store owners into carrying it.
I would love to kind of zoom out to like 30,000 feet at the end of the show here. Because we've talked to a lot of people on this program. I know this is always the sign of a good interview
so
is that
fast.
Like, I know. Well, we can keep talking and do a little bonus content for our regulars over on our Patreon page. But
yeah, I want to talk about cannabis and psychedelics with our secret space.
Perfect. Exactly. Yeah. That's
and how that affects drinking.
That's the members only. That's the chef's table. You gotta we'll get you an invite over on our Patreon page, folks. But
okay.
At the end of this show, I wanted to ask, you know, we've had a lot of discussion on this show, and there's been a lot of discussion, not just in beverage spaces, but in like, you know, vanilla spaces. Like this is, I've seen a lot of articles, not in like, you know, the business section or like the style section, but in like the main section of a lot of newspapers, like why are people, particularly younger people, drinking at historic lows? You know, there have been a lot of theories as to why this trend has occurred. And I don't think that any of them are necessarily wrong. I think that it's undoubtedly a combination of factors, as everything is, but I'd love to hear kind of your take of why this consumer driven trend is so strong and has the muscly legs that it has and seems to, if anything, especially as a lot of tried and true categories, particularly beer, really drop in sales. Like what is powering this and what sort of on a cultural zeitgeist level do you think is happening?
Oh man. Souther, you want to start?
I think it's because young people are boring. How about that?
You guys stink.
And there goes half our audience. See you later, guys.
You got to be.
No, come
you
back.
Gotta be, you got to be
back.
Interested to be interesting.
To be able to kind of understand that, you kind of have to probably live that for a day. Like it's, is the age range. I want to know what the age range is. Is it 21 to 27 or is it 18 to 20? Like, is it, I'm interested to see how other substances that are people that people are taking that have age restrictions that are much lower, affect their want or desire to consume. Because I think that like, I think anxiety, I think something that if people are anxious and they drink alcohol, in my opinion, I think that it increases the anxiety. If not the same day, then maybe the next day a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And if you are someone that doesn't necessarily have a grip on who they are yet and what they like, do you like the color blue? Do you like the color red? Do you like all the colors? And if you have a question of who your social circle is, what your social circle is, if you're drinking something that not only kind of like depresses you, because alcohol is a depressant, I drink, I know the effects, I know how I take my risks, I understand what happens. I think that there is a lot to say about health, mental health, and drinking and what that kind of does for a mind and for a person. If you're drinking to a level that you can't necessarily have control over yourself, I think that that can be a problem. And I think that maybe there have been a few experiences that younger people have had, and they don't want to kind of lose control. And also the other thing, guys, everything is recorded nowadays. If you're drunk in a chair and somebody draws all over your face, that's going to be on social media in 10 seconds amongst all your friends. If you're like, we didn't have that back then. We kind of like, I went to college.
How fortunate we are that we didn't.
But for real though, it's just like, if you're, you know, if you're on some edibles with cannabis and you just go to take a nap, you go home, you take a nap. I think that if you're doing some crazy things, people will show you what you're doing. And I think alcohol, there's definitely other things, other substances that cause you to act out or cause you to kind of be a little different than what you are. But I think the recording culture and people experimenting with cannabis, with psychedelics, with even just functional mushrooms that are lowering their anxiety, and then realizing that they're good with one drink or they're good with no drinks or just something lower proof. I think people are having kind of like a really big understanding of like what is good for them and what is not good for them. And I think before there was also a lot of pressure to drink, right? Like, you know, Greg, you said it yourself. I want to join that person at the bar, but I don't want to drink. You know what? I'm going to have a non-alcoholic option and I'm still going to enjoy that company and catching up with someone. I think that pressure from like drinking is cool. It's a wonderful cocktail that is super creative and incredible, in my opinion, is artful and amazing. But just like chugging vodka, I don't know how cool that is anymore. I think cool has shifted. And I think power within yourself, I think understanding yourself, figuring yourself out. I see a lot of younger people doing that more instead of just like herd mentality. I think they're, you know, there's small pods of people that are in their own cultural bubbles and drinking. Like I went to Bar Belly the other day. It was like a birthday party. It's a much younger crowd. I looked around and waters, one bottle of champagne, empty glasses, waters, soda waters, they're having the time of their life. Who knows what they're on, but it seemed fun. The bar, the tab probably wasn't as high as people would want it to be, but I think there's a shift, and it might be with anxiety, it might be with people just choosing not to drink, but I think cool has shifted, whatever that means, in my opinion.
I think that's certainly a valid angle to look at. We are running a bit long, so we need to cut it off. But it's been a great conversation with you, Yuna, and talking about NA. And, you know, as Greg said earlier, you know, the shows that go by the fastest are the ones that were riveting conversation that we couldn't get out of. So really happy to have you on and go a little bit long and talk about the NA category in general and the fact that you're kind of running one of the first sort of portfolios to, dedicated to that sector. Where can people follow along with you to see what's going on in the NA world that you're creating?
You can follow Sips with Yunz, SipsWithYunz. That is my Instagram for non-alcoholic things. You can follow me there. Right. Website, catchallcollective.com. I'm going to start putting more attention to that and kind of talking about some of the trends that I'm seeing and working with some of the amazing buyers and bar managers and beverage directors that I've been kind of working with over these past 2 years, almost 2 years, you know, 2 years in June, which is kind of cool, but built something really special and I hope to keep growing it.
That's amazing.
That sounds great. And we'll look forward to your prediction of the summer of shandies.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to do it for us on the Speakeasy today. Thank you so much for joining us and for tuning in. I just want to say two quick things before we go. First of all, this is the 15-year anniversary of HRN, and we're in the middle of a fundraiser right now. It would really, really mean a lot if you went over to our homepage, click the beating heart at the top of the website, and entered for a chance to win some really, really cool prizes, including dinner for two in one of 10 amazing, amazing cities in the U.S. So really, really awesome chance to win some good stuff there and support a network that produces a lot of quality shows and this one. Also want to say, I know we've referenced this a couple times during this show, but we have our Bottled and Bond program going now. That's our Patreon page just for our beloved regulars. Sign up today and become one of our regulars. We're actually going to have a little bonus episode there where we talk to Yuna a little bit more about some perhaps other substances that we didn't get a chance to get into today, but I'm very, very excited to chat about them. You're also going to get cool content over there, like sponsor-free listening, video podcasts, access to pre-sales and perks, and the chance to have Souther Damon and I come and throw you a party once a year. So go over there, check it out. There's a link in the show notes. And if you were a member of the previous iteration of Bottled and Bond, drop me a line because I want to hear from you. And I want to thank you for being one of our beta testers and maybe send you something fun. But for now, that's going to be it for the Speakeasy. So until next time, cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Cheers. So you don't shun
the devil with your rock. The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.